Friday night, I accompanied some of our guys. They were being interviewed on live television. That was cool. And so I got to know why. Have you ever seen people on live TV and in the crowd and they just look puzzled or funny? I realized why. The cameraman has a camera that has such bright light. So you really have no idea if they're facing you. You have no idea what to do. You're blinded, so you're just staring like a fool. Then for a few minutes, there could have been an image that looks like me. I cannot confirm or deny. I cannot confirm. It depends on whether you are happy to see me. If you're happy to see me there, that was me. If it concerned you, sorry. Who knows where I was? I could have been in bed. So one day walking around the streets, I just felt the need to look at people's faces. Because, you know, we become so busy when we're walking around our city or, you know, wherever you come from. And so for this one time, I just stopped rushing and decided to look at people's faces. And I felt the Holy Spirit ask me, how many of the people I was looking at have probably just lost someone they love, or have probably just lost a relationship they really valued, or are stuck in an abusive relationship? How many are coming from a broken family, or from a family that is in the process of being broken? How many have just lost their homes or their places of business? You see, when we walk in town, we can almost think that those are just faces. But those faces have names. Those faces have a story. Some are in celebration, some are in pain. That's why often when we start our celebration on Sunday morning, we invite you guys to be open to God meeting you, even if you're coming from a place of joy or a place of sorrow. Because as Joel said, God is present with us. Jesus is with us. But sometimes we just see people and we think they're just faces. Or we're also too busy, so we don't realize these aren't just faces. They have names. They have a story. And some of those stories are particularly very difficult. Because we all know what times of suffering feel like. And quite frankly, it's interesting that when something goes wrong, it's never just that one thing. You know, when it rains, it pours. Almost feels like it never rains, it always pours. When something goes wrong, then it's another, and then it's another. You're kicked out of your place of business, and then your landlord remembers, oh, wow, you haven't paid rent, so you're kicked out of your house. It's weird that when hard times come, and we all know what that means, because we know that we always get hard seasons, when hard time comes, they can be particularly very hard. And for some people, those seasons are longer. For some people, those seasons are even harder. For some, it's a combination of both. They are long and hard. You're sick in your body, and it just doesn't seem to go away. And you've spent tons of money just trying to get well, and just it's not going away. So why do we suffer, and where is God when we suffer? When our dreams are broken, when our hopes are lost, when we are sick, or when we lose loved ones, or we lose relationships we held dear, when the sting of pain and suffering is our companion, where is God? Sitting here today, some of us are in celebration, but some of us are in deep pain. Where is God in those times? So as a community of faith, I want us to explore that. I want us to explore suffering in our new series that we begin today. When it hurts, will God meet us in our pain? Is God mad at us and therefore allowing things to happen or punishing us? Does our pain even count, or is it all for nothing? Is there something to be done in those times, or do we just sit there and take it all in? Let's pray. It's incredible how you love us, Jesus. It's incredible. But Father, it's so easy in the darkest of nights to to not see any of that, to be in a place where none of what everything we know and have believed and have held on to cease to make sense. But Lord, we ask that you encourage us today. We ask that your Spirit brings us strength. Father, as we share this, may your kingdom come. Holy Spirit, just open our eyes and open our ears to see and hear from only you. In Jesus' name. So the Bible has a very interesting story of a man for whom it just didn't rain. It poured. And I know some of you already know, oh, he's going to talk about this guy. And, it's a particularly very difficult story because it was such intense suffering for one man. And so the guy's called Job. And, you know, right before we get into the story, there's always a debate about, you know, is the story of Job a parable or is it an actual story? And, you know, what does it matter? You know, whichever side we choose, we can only speculate, right? Job could have been an actual person, and then this story was written, or it could have been a parable. We have no problem with Jesus using parables. Or he could have been an actual person, and then over time, as the story is passed on from generation to generation, some of the details of his story became allegorical. Still, none of it takes away the truth that the Spirit of God... the truth of the Spirit of God through the story that is there. So Job is an interesting story of humanity's struggle with pain and suffering, in my view. Because this guy had everything in that context that a man could desire in life. He had wealth, he had family, he was at peace with God, he was respected in his society. He had everything a man could desire in that time. And even that, even having all that, he lost it all. And then he has dialogues with his friends and his wife that are going to show us some of the interesting philosophies that we use to try and rationalize suffering, even to this day. Thousands of years later, we still think in very similar patterns, interestingly. So let's see what happens in the story. Job 1, in the land of Uz, there lived a man whose name was Job. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters, and he owned 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 donkeys, and had a large number of servants. He was the greatest man among all the people of the East. His sons used to host hold feasts in their homes on their birthdays. And today is the birthday of one of us. Happy birthday, Vanessa. So their sons used to host birthday parties on their birthdays, and they would invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. When the period of feasting had run its course, Job would make arrangements for them to be purified. Even in the morning, he would sacrifice a burnt offering for each of them, thinking, perhaps my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. This was Job's regular custom. Okay, this is a very wealthy person. In those days, wealth was measured by how much livestock you have, and he had, and how big your family was, and how many servants you had, and he had plenty. He had plenty of livestock, plenty of servants, and Job had a perfect family: 7 sons and 3 and 3 daughters. For Jews, for whom the story is written and included in the Old Testament, 7 was a very important number. It was the number of perfection, of completeness. So societies have a way of speaking. There are certain words and certain numbers that mean something to each society. For instance, if you met a Kenyan somewhere in the world and said, hey, I'm from the 254, they know what you're talking about. Those who are not Kenyan in this room go, what's that? Or if you met an American and said, oh, yeah, I was just at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, they know what you're talking about. So numbers, there's certain phrases, certain numbers mean certain things to in different societies. So the reputation of these numbers, they're trying to give a picture of what kind of family and wealth this guy had. And so they're saying he had a perfect family, the kind of family you'd desire. Job was the ideal man, respected in society. Who wouldn't want that? People respect you. You have the wealth. You have your definition of a perfect family, and you have reverence for God. He's very intentional about his family, that even without whether his kids have wronged God or not, he goes ahead to make sure things have been done right. That's how intentional he is about his relationship with God. The story continues. One day, the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them. The Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Satan answered the Lord, "From roaming throughout the earth, going back and forth from it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil." The picture here is that this guy wasn't just pretending before men and women, that even God found him blameless. Because there are people, everyone thinks they're great, but then if you actually got to see their hearts, you go, you've been putting up a show. So the guy telling us the story wants us to know that Job's righteousness wasn't just a show. He actually was blameless even and upright even before God. So things get interesting after that. Satan asks, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not put a hedge around him and his household and everything he has? You have blessed the work of his hands so that his flocks and herds are spread throughout the land. But now, stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and he will surely curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Very well then, everything he has is in your power. But on the man himself, do not lay a finger." Then Satan went out of the presence of the Lord. One day, Job's sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house. A messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing and the donkeys were grazing nearby. And the Sabians attacked and made off with them. They put the servants to the sword, and I'm the only one who remained, and I've come to tell you." So he's lost something. When he was still speaking, so Job is sitting there with his kids. One guy comes rushing in. "Oh, all your oxen are gone. And the servants were taking care of them. They've been killed too." And when this guy is still speaking, another one comes in and says, "Oh, wow, fire from God came from the heavens and burnt your sheep and the guy who was taking care of the sheep." Oh, wow, this is happening so fast. And while he's still taking that in, another guy comes in and says, "Oh, the Chaldeans formed 3 raiding parties and swept down your camels and made off with them. And then they killed everyone who was taking care of the camels. And I'm the only one who's remained, and I've come to tell you." Sitting right there, Job receives news that he's lost everything. Job receives news that, that company has fallen, and you had saved this money in this bank account, and that one has gone under too. And the 3 houses that you had built, they just got torched. In one sitting, Job receives news that everything is gone, and they didn't have insurance companies back then. So overnight, Job loses all his wealth. Then while he was still sitting there, another guy comes and says, "Your sons and daughters were feasting as usual, and they were drinking wine at their brother's house, when suddenly mighty wind swept in from the desert and struck the 4 corners of the house. It collapsed on them, and they're dead. I'm the only one who has remained to come and tell you." Now, it's one thing to lose everything you owned. It's another thing to lose all your kids at one go and at the same time. And Job tore his clothes, his robe, and shaved his head. He was mourning. Then he fell to the ground in worship. I kind of like that. His first response, even in his grief, was to worship. "Naked I came from my mother's womb." I almost said mamas. That's not in this translation. "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised." That's just crazy. That's not a place we can easily find ourselves in. So, because when it rains, it pours, Job loses his wealth, and in that same moment loses his entire family. See, Thousands of years later, we still haven't learned that putting our hope in wealth is really hopeless. Thousands of years later, we still think that sometimes we think that the amount of money you have in your bank or the number of pieces of land you have are actually our hope, but they're not. Thousands of years later, we still are stuck in that place. And here is Job who had it all. And all of a sudden, they were lost and he couldn't do a thing about it. Thousands of years later, we still think that our idea of a perfect family is where our hope is. So you can do everything to raise your kids right, or maybe you're just given right kids, and so you're not doing a lot of work, but you can do everything to get your perfect family, but that's not where our hope really is. Because in one moment, everything can change. You can be standing in one space, and in a moment, everything changes. You know, I grew up in what I thought was a perfect family. So I was available for people who came from what I thought were broken families, and I tried to be encouragement, and I tried to embrace them. But I never quite got it, because I came from a perfect family, loving dad, loving mom, they were always available. I mean, the best parents can do, they can still mess us up. But, you know, I thought, nah, they haven't done so badly. What, do you guys? I think they did a great job. Anyway, 3 a.m., I go to bed one night, and at 3 a.m., my mom calls me and says she's leaving home because things aren't going great with my dad. I was in the same bed, but in that moment, my life just changed because my family isn't perfect anymore. Was it even perfect to begin with? Do I even know how families are supposed to work? In one moment, everything, you know, your entire reality can just change. So where is our hope? And in the face of crisis, our wealth, our picture-perfect families, they just can't do a thing for us. So where is our hope? You see, I guess the guy telling the story wants us to know one thing, that even the best of us suffer. Because sometimes we can be caught up in the place of, you know, you think you're the only one suffering, or you think, well, rich people don't suffer. Well, Job had it all. Even the best of us suffer. Well, you think, well, you know, I look at your family, and I'm guessing, Joe, you have a great family. I don't think you guys go through hard stuff. Well, even the best of families suffer. Or you're looking at someone and you think he is a great example of what a relationship with God looks like. Well, here's the thing. Even the most faithful in our view suffer. Even, you know, even the most faithful in God's view suffered. Because Jesus was the faithful son, and he suffered. See, the reality is that in this age, the reality of our life is that in this age, we will suffer. Jesus promises his disciples and says, in the world, you will have trouble. The reality is we will suffer, and it's universal. Even the best of us. So if you're sitting here and you're thinking, where did I go wrong? Even the best of us. Suffering will get even the best of us. But we are not doomed, you see. Because we have seen God come through. You have seen God come through for you in different times. When people got healed immediately, when they received prayer. They got healed gradually. That was God coming through and ending suffering. When you carried a bag of food last week and the week before to someone who needed food, that was God coming through and ending their suffering that day. So we've seen God coming through, both miraculously and both in the subtle acts of God through his people, through the church. That's because when Jesus came to earth, he brought God's kingdom, which was ending suffering. But again, we have the journey continues, and so we have to wait for the return of our King. So until then, we live in that tension of the now my suffering has ended and I wait for my suffering to end. That's why we live in that tension of, oh, you know, one day I was sick and I got healed immediately, but there's this one thing that never seems to go away. We live in that tension of the now and the not yet. Let's go back to Job's story. So after he loses everything, he is still unbroken and he falls in worship, right? Guess what? The enemy goes back to God and says, no, that's because you still have him healthy, because he thinks he can then recreate everything he had. And Job becomes very, very sick, but he doesn't die. He's just sick, helplessly sick. So he can't feed himself. Some parts of the story he says he eats tears for breakfast, for meals. He can't feed himself. We all have hard seasons. Some are harder than others. Some are longer than others. Some are hard and long. But we all have those seasons. And this is what Job was in. But this was intense. And so his wife comes to him. And his wife has a very interesting approach to suffering. In Job 2:9, his wife said to him, "Are you still maintaining your integrity? Curse God and die." Don't we also just get there? His wife represents a very common view of many people who've rejected God. When we see people suffering, when some people see others suffer, they ask, "How could God exist and let there be so much suffering in the world?" Atheism. Some people have rejected God for this very reason. How could God exist and let there be so much suffering in the world? But you see, those who argue God doesn't exist because of so much suffering, do you realize often it's not the people who are suffering that do that? Someone probably, they often point to places of hunger in Africa and wars in the Middle East, and it breaks their heart, granted. But then they go, "Oh, wow, if those people can be that hungry and God exists, that's just not right." But interestingly, just like in the story of Job, the people suffering sometimes are still holding on to faith. That just puzzles me. Anyway, so people who decide that God doesn't exist, if suffering is that prevalent in the world, then say that everything is just random. Everything just happens because it happens. Nothing's good, nothing's bad, God doesn't exist. But then think about it. Every human being has an innate sense of right and wrong. You have an innate sense of good and bad from the time you were born. Where did that come from? If everything is random, then nothing is good and bad. Then nothing is justice. So none of us should be saying, "Oh, well, this person needs justice." Because then they claim, yeah, you can be a good person without really needing the being of a God. But then how do you become what is called good if that, what is the yardstick for good? It has to come from somewhere because we know it. Those of us who've given up on God, you have a sense of right and wrong. Whether you keep it or not, you have a sense of right and wrong. What you call crooked because you know what straight looks like. Where does that come from? So life is not just random. That's why I think those who reject God for this particular reason and assume life is random, that is a self-defeating argument. Because life can't be random, and then you claim that there is good and bad. Or if you're living in the days of Job, it was not very popular to reject the existence of God. And some of us are in that position. You were born in a Christian family, or you were born in a family that believed in God, and so it's not very popular in your family to reject God. So you don't reject the existence of God. You simply believe that God exists, but he has nothing to do with his creation. He's just uninvolved. That's what people call deism. He's just uninvolved. God's not interested. Or you go to the extent of thinking, he might be interested, but at least not in me. So you think, yeah, if God exists, he's just too busy, too uninvolved. But again, that's not true. Because we have seen God, we've seen God come through for people, for us. The creator is greater than the creation. So people end up saying things like, please pray for me, because I don't think God hears my prayer. You've decided that in your reality, God exists, but he is outside of that reality. But that's not true. Because how could God invite us? So we think he's uninvolved. But the truth is, we wouldn't trust God if he messed with every decision you made. That wouldn't be a very trustworthy God. If every decision you made, he interfered with it, again, you wouldn't trust that kind of God. How could God invite us into a relationship with him when he just messes up with everything? You see, God is fully in control, but God is not controlling. There's so many other things happening in the world around us. Nature, spiritual forces, and even the acts of men. God is in control, but he is not controlling. And he does intervene, and he does interact with us. And he's inviting each one of us, come, walk with me. I will walk with you. After his wife comes along, another friend of Job comes, and they were trying to comfort him. And Job was just mourning and grieving and complaining. And they're tired of keeping quiet, kind of like when we know our friends who are mourning and we're around them. We forget that sometimes silence is actually the best thing. And we decide, let's just cheap in and give them a bit of theology. That's what's happening here. Job's first friend says, consider now, who being innocent has ever perished? Where were the upright ever destroyed? As I have observed, those who plow evil and those who sow trouble reap it. And at the breath of God, they perish. At the blast of his anger, they are no more. In other words, this friend of Job is saying, actually, I think this is your fault. You must have done something wrong to deserve this. The idea of karma. What goes around comes around. That if you sow trouble, you reap trouble. But they forget that even God found Job blameless. Now, actually, in the story, this guy continues to tell him, well, we know, because everyone knew Job to be upright and blameless. He tells him, we know that everyone thinks you're upright and blameless, but no one can be more upright than God. So God, in his righteousness, must have found something in the difference, and that's why you're being punished. Don't we encounter such people? When you're in trouble, they tell you why this has to be your fault. And if you can't see anything wrong, you tell them, well, you know, we're all sinners. God has picked one of those sins, you know. This has to be your fault. Yes, and certainly, the idea of what you sow is what you reap, there's truth in that. You do not plant mangoes and hope to reap bananas. Trust me, if you punch a wall, it will hurt really bad. If you don't invest in your relationships with your children, they will walk away from you. They might walk away from you. You sowed something, you're reaping back. If you fail to find your taxes in time, you'll be in trouble with the government. Ask me. It's not fun. If you break the law is going to come for you. Certainly, our choices have consequences. But is that the whole truth? When we throw this at people who are suffering, is that the whole truth? What did the children in the war zones of the middle of the world deserve the kind of suffering they are under? What did a child fighting cancer do to deserve that? What did he sow? Or is God in the business of just finding sin in us to just punish us? That even a child, because God is more righteous than all of us, he just goes, oh yeah, you must have done something. Maybe in your dream, there must be some. Is God in that business? Because you see, that's not the picture of the father that Jesus paints. In our news cycles, there's a story of a girl who probably had an affair with a high-profile person in one of the counties. And so she certainly made a few mistakes, right? And every choice has a consequence. But she was found brutally murdered. What did she do to deserve that? Or what did her family do to deserve the grief they're in? Or what did her unborn child do to deserve what she is, to be murdered? See, that's not the picture of the father that Jesus paints. The king that Jesus paints, the kind of God that Jesus paints is very different. He's a God who pursues humanity with all he's got. That's why he loved the world and came to it. He's pursuing us. He's not after us. He's not out to get you. He's out to get you. You get the difference? Tried something there. And if people were to get what they deserve, because those of us who throw this at people who are suffering, do you really want to get what you deserve? Because Jesus paints a very different picture, a God of grace, a God who gives us more than we actually deserve. That everything we've got is because of grace. So that isn't the entire truth of the world. Actually, God is always holding us. God's always keeping us. Your joy isn't because you worked harder. You didn't do any better than the person who's suffering. And your pain, God's not out to get you. That's not grace. Grace is what God is offering through his son Jesus, where he says, come to me and I'll give you better than you deserve. Come to me and I'll give you everything I am. Come to me and I'll give you my righteousness. Do you know what that means? That gap that Job's friend was pointing to between God and Job, Jesus fills it up and says, well, if God looks at Job, if God looks at you, he sees his righteousness. So God's not out to punish us, because he's looking at you and seeing the righteousness of Jesus. And then one other philosophy that we try to use to rationalize suffering is that the world has two opposite forces and they're equal. The idea of dualism, represented by the Chinese yin and yang. Good and bad are opposite and equal forces balancing the world. And yes, there is a grand war. The enemy of our souls is the enemy of God. He's opposed to God and everything that is good. But don't be mistaken. God is unmatched. God is unrivaled. He's not equal to God in power. In your time of pain, don't for a second think that God has lost, that you have lost. You haven't. God is fully in control and settled in his throne. God is sovereign over all. Look at the picture the story of Job paints, that even Satan had to ask for permission. He's on a leash. Anything that is brought against you, the enemy's on a leash. The enemy's on a leash. God is sovereign over all. God is sovereign over nature. God is sovereign over men. God is sovereign over our governments. God is sovereign over all. You see, the problem with this idea is that it creates in us an attitude of defeatism or resignation, where you decide that, well, good and bad happen. Good and bad are at war and they're equal, and men are just pawns or collateral damage. What then do you decide to do? I can do nothing about it. So we don't serve the weak anymore. Why? Because, well, evil and good are at war and we are helpless about it. We don't feed the hungry anymore. Why? Because what can you do? We don't pray anymore for our country because, well, bad has taken the day. We don't ask God for healing anymore because we don't expect it. Unless good wins tomorrow. It just creates an attitude of defeatism and resignation. And then where is hope? How do you live a life without hope? It's pointless. But God is fully in charge. God is unmatched and he's unrivaled. And he's in charge even in our times of pain. You see, we could go on and on with different philosophies that we pick on ourselves to rationalize why people suffer. But the question of suffering is universal. It's ageless. It's timeless. But I love how the story of Job ends, because God shows up. So Job keeps having an argument with his friends, and his main question is, where is God so that I can ask him questions? Have you ever felt like that? You just want, where is God at this time? I want to know why me? Why now? So Job wanted an audience with God, and you know what? God shows up. Even when we're just foolish in our ideas about God, even when we don't quite understand what we think or believe about God, God still shows up. That's what I like about the ending of the story of Job. God gives Job an audience. He listens to him. He corrects him. And then guess what? He corrects the situation. He brings justice. He restores him. He restores his family. He restores his faith. Just like in that story, God shows up even in our pain. At the end of the story of Job, God showed up. And this is what happened and still happens when Jesus moved into our reality. God was responding to all that was unjust in the world. The story of the Bible is a story of God breaking through. The story of the Bible is a story of God confronting the powers of the enemy, confronting injustice, setting things right. The psalmist says, rejoice because God is coming in his justice. This is what was happening at the end of the story of Job. And this is what happened when Jesus came. He came to set things right. Set things right when suffering is caused by the fallen nature of nature. I wonder, if nature wasn't fallen, if mosquitoes would still spread malaria. I just wonder, what would they do in a perfect world? For the wrongs done to us and the wrongs we have done, God in Jesus moves in and set things right. For the suffering we undergo because of the wickedness of men, God moves in through Jesus and set things right. And simply, God, Jesus coming in just started changing things. Because what was happening is that Jesus brought the power that was at the end of the story of Job into the middle of the story. Jesus brought the power that is available, the hope that is available for us at the end of the story of humanity in this age. Jesus brought it and made it accessible even now. So he walks around and he heals people and he sets people free. And he brings hope and he brings salvation. Jesus was bringing the hope of the end right now, making it accessible. So what does that mean? You can get healed. In this very moment, the hope for your healing is present. The power for your healing is present in this very moment. So you don't have to sit in defeatism thinking, oh, well, now I have to sit here and wait for when I die and Jesus raises me up whole. Well, that's possible now. The end of the story has just crashed into the middle of the story. It has invaded the middle of the story. And that's why we see, even today, the same thing still happening. Healing. People loving the poor. When we gather like this and in a moment of worship, we are present with God and it's like all your tears are washed away. It's like you have pain no more. You have hope. You have faith. That is the power and the hope that we look forward to meeting us now. And it's present. It's accessible even in your suffering today. I'm going to call George back up on stage as I come to a conclusion. However, we still have to get to the end of the story. We still have to get to the end of the story. So the power of God that is accessible now came through Jesus in the middle of the story, but the story continues. So we still have to get to the end of the story. What that means is sometimes, yes, we will suffer. The power of God living side by side by the forces that are against you. Not in equal measure. It's the now and the not yet. It's the power to get healed immediately, and we live in that hope and we live in that expectancy. But it's also the hope that one day I will get healed. But you see, Jesus coming in the middle of the story says something very special, that you are not alone. He not only cares and understands, but he's walking with us towards the end of the story. That's what happened. Jesus coming to us in the middle of the story meant that he's walking with us towards the end of the story. So even in our suffering, whether you get healed now or later, Jesus is with us. And that's the hope we live in. But he's not just with us. He's not just walking with us. Look at this, what we find in Philippians. Who, Jesus, though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men, and being found in human form. He humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. He isn't just walking with us. He suffers with us. I like what Joel read today, because it was part of what we were going to do, but I thought it was just going to be too much. In Isaiah is just giving a picture of Jesus before he comes, and he says, he is wounded. He suffers. We even think he's rejected by God. Just looking at who Jesus was, we would think he was rejected by God because of how much he suffered. You know what God was saying? That I am not only coming for you, I'm going to be with you, I'm going to suffer with you. He not only understands your pain, he feels your pain. So we could never get answers for suffering, but there is hope in just knowing that God deliberately chose to be part of our human experience, including our suffering. Whether it's hunger, whether it's demonic forces, whether it's just wicked men who've not yielded their hearts to Jesus that are causing us to suffer, God is right there with us, going through it with us. Our hope is alive. Our hope has a name. Our hope is Jesus going through it all with us. Our hope is Jesus coming back. So I want to invite you to stand. So if our healing comes now, we celebrate. If our healing is delayed, we celebrate. If our marriages are healed now, we celebrate. If healing for our marriages is delayed, we celebrate, even as we cry. Wars in different countries can end tomorrow, so we pray. Wars in different countries may continue, so we still pray. When the war is won, and there is no more pain, we will praise. But even when it hurts, we will still praise.